still managed to fit in 28 years of retirement before dying in 1829 at the age of 83. The Jay Treaty also angered the French, who stepped up their attacks on U.S. ships. In 1797, President Adams sent U.S. envoys to Paris to meet with the French Foreign Minister, Charles Talleyrand. But upon their arrival, the Americans were met by three go-betweens known publicly only as X, Y, and Z, who tried to get a $250,000 bribe from the Americans just for the chance to meet with Talleyrand. The U.S. envoys told X, Y, and Z to stick it and returned home. So for about 2 years, France and the United States waged an undeclared war on the seas. The newly created U.S. Navy captured about 80 French ships, and the French continued to prey on American vessels. Then, Adams did a remarkable thing. Ignoring the fact that war fever was raging and declaring war on France could help him win a second term as president, Adams sent another peace team back to Paris in 1800. This time, the two countries made a deal. Adams kept the United States out of war, but he also lost re-election to the presidency and sealed the doom of the Federalist Party in doing so. Part 2. Growing Pains. In this part, the people of the United States march westward. A civil war divides the country. The U.S. tries to reconstruct the South and rebuild the Union. Chapter 7. Long Tom and One Weird War, 1800 to 1815. In this chapter, getting the deal of the century, the Louisiana Purchase, paving the way to the Pacific, the Lewis and Clark Expedition, being stuck in the middle between Great Britain and France, struggling through the War of 1812. The turn of the century brought what has been called the Revolution of 1800. The term, first used by Thomas Jefferson, refers to the fact that for the first time in the young country's history, America saw one political party give up power to another. In this chapter, you see how well it worked. Look at the development of the U.S. Supreme Court in the grand scheme of things, sit in on a big land sale, and fight some pirates. I wrap it up with a pretty weird war with the British. Jefferson gets a job. President John F. Kennedy once hosted a dinner party at the White House and invited a guest list so impressive that he joked it was the finest group of genius and talent to sit at the table since Thomas Jefferson dined alone. Kennedy's quip held as much truth as humor. A tall, loose-limbed man who was said to amble more than walk and was thus nicknamed Long Tom, Jefferson was a statesman, a writer, an inventor, a farmer, an architect, a musician, a scientist, and a philosopher. Thus, it may not be surprising that he was also a bundle of contradictions. Jefferson was an idealist who could bend the rules when he needed to accomplish something. A slave owner who hated slavery. A man who believed Africans were naturally inferior, yet for years had one of his slaves as his mistress. A believer in sticking to the letter of the Constitution who ignored it on at least one major issue during his presidency. A guy who preached frugality for the country, yet died $100,000 in debt. But Jefferson's contradictory nature made him flexible, and flexibility in a president can be a very valuable asset. In addition, Jefferson was a true man of the people, much more so than his predecessors George Washington and John Adams. He did away with the imperial trappings that had built up around the office, sometimes greeting visitors to the White House in his robe and slippers. That kind of informality added to the popularity he already enjoyed as author of the Declaration of Independence. Remember, But public popularity meant diddly-squat in the election of 1800 because of the screwy way the Constitution's drafters had set up the presidential election process. Republican Jefferson received the votes of 73 members of the Electoral College, while Federalist incumbent John Adams snagged 65. But the electors were required by the Constitution to list two names, with the second-highest vote-getter becoming vice president. And as it happened, the 73 electors who voted for Jefferson also listed a New York politician named Aaron Burr, who had helped deliver New York to the Republican side. That meant a tie between Jefferson and Burr, and the winner had to be decided by the House of Representatives, which was still controlled by the Federalists. The goofy system was done away with by the 12th Amendment to the Constitution, which was added before the next presidential election in 1804. The Federalists took their cues mainly from Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton disliked Jefferson, but he detested Burr with good reason. To call Burr a reptile is a slur to cold-blooded creatures everywhere. Born to a wealthy New Jersey family and well-educated, Burr established the first true political machine in the United States. He was a power-hungry schemer and a dangerous opportunist. But even with Hamilton's grudging support, it took 35 ballots before the House gave the presidency to Jefferson, with Burr becoming vice president. In return, Jefferson privately promised not to oust all the Federalist office holders in the government, a promise he mostly kept. As president, Jefferson played to his supporters, who were mainly in the South and West. He pushed bills through Congress that changed the time required to become a citizen from 14 to 5 years, and repealed the tax on whiskey. Because he wasn't very good at finances, he left the government's financial fortunes in the hands of his Swiss-born Secretary of the Treasury, Albert Gallatin, and Gallatin managed to cut the national debt almost in half. Sally and Tom. When Jefferson ran for re-election in 1804, the nastiest bit of campaigning against him was a claim that he had an affair with one of his slaves, a woman named Sally Hemings, beginning while he was U.S. envoy to France. Moreover, the story was that he had fathered children by her. Jefferson ignored the charges and easily won re-election. The issue seemingly died with Jefferson and was largely ignored by historians until the 1970s, when two books revived the rumor and claimed it was true. Jefferson apologists howled, and their arguments ranged from the lack of concrete evidence to back up the assertion to the contention that Jefferson was impotent. But in 1998, some pretty concrete evidence did surface in the form of DNA samples taken from the descendants of Jefferson and Hemings. The conclusion: Jefferson and Hemings had children together. In 2000, a commission formed by the Thomas Jefferson Foundation concluded that the weight of all evidence indicated a high probability that Jefferson and Hemings had been more than friends. It was probably no coincidence, then, that the only slaves Jefferson ever freed during his lifetime were Sally Hemings' four surviving children. John Marshall. John Marshall quite possibly represented the most important accomplishment of the John Adams administration, becoming the patron saint of the U.S. Supreme Court. A distant cousin of Thomas Jefferson, Marshall was born in 1835 in a log cabin in Virginia, where his father was active in politics. After serving in the Continental Army, including the winter at Valley Forge, Marshall earned his law degree and entered politics. In 1799, he went to Congress. In 1800, he became Adams' Secretary of State, and in January 1801, Adams appointed him Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. It was a job Marshall held until his death, 34 years later. During his tenure as Chief Justice, he led a series of landmark decisions that established the court's role as a key player in American government and strengthened the power of the federal government. But he also had a good time. According to one story, Marshall suggested to his fellow justices that on days they were considering a case, they should only drink hard spirits if it was raining. When the sun continued to shine in Washington, however, Marshall decided that because the court had jurisdiction over the entire nation, justices should drink only when it rained somewhere in America. Disorder in the court. One of the last things the Federalist-controlled Congress did before giving way to the Jeffersonian Republicans in early 1801 was to create 16 new federal circuit court judgeships. Federalist President John Adams then spent until 9 p.m. the last day of his term filling the judgeships with Federalists. But when the Republicans took over, they promptly repealed the law creating the judgeships, and the judges were out of a job, along with a few dozen other judicial appointees made by Adams in his last days as president. One of them, a guy named William Marbury, didn't take it gracefully. Marbury sued Jefferson's Secretary of State, James Madison, for refusing to give him his judicial commission, and the case went to the U.S. Supreme Court. In 1803, the court made a historic ruling. The justices said that though Marbury's appointment was legal, another section of the 1789 law that created the federal judiciary in the first place was unconstitutional because it gave powers to the judiciary that weren't spelled out in the Constitution and weren't within the power of Congress to create. The ruling marked the first time the Supreme Court ruled an action taken by Congress to be unconstitutional. The result was that the court asserted its place as a co-equal with the legislative, congressional, and executive, presidential branches. But the Republicans weren't done. A Supreme Court justice named Samuel Chase, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, so irritated the Jeffersonians with his harangues from the bench that they took to naming vicious dogs after him. Then, in 1804, the Republican-controlled Congress took it a step further by impeaching him. Remember, Chase was tried by the Senate, but because he really hadn't done anything that would warrant removing him from the court, he was acquitted. It was the last formal attempt by elected officials from one political party to reshape the court by directly pushing justices appointed by another party off the bench, although there have been numerous efforts to block nominee Senate confirmations. Free from partisan machinations, justices were thus freer to make decisions based on the law as they saw it. Growing by leaps and bounds. The young United States was a restless rascal, and like most kids, it was growing so fast you couldn't keep it in shoes. The census of 1800 reported a population of 5.3 million, including about 900,000 slaves, a whopping 35% increase over 1790. About 8 in 10 Americans lived and worked on farms. The largest states were still Virginia, Pennsylvania, and New York. More significantly, the fastest growing were Tennessee and Kentucky, which had nearly tripled in population since 1790. Americans were moving west. One of the reasons for this move was that in some areas, they had literally worn out their welcome. Tobacco can be as tough on soil as it is on lungs, and the crop had depleted a lot of land in the south. In the north, the growing population helped drive up the price of land to $14 to $50 an acre. But in the west, which in 1800 was what was or would become Michigan, Ohio, Kentucky, Tennessee, Indiana, and Illinois, federal government land could be bought for less than $2 an acre. Of course, Native Americans occupied some of it, but in the first few years of the 19th century, government officials, such as Indiana Territory Governor William Henry Harrison, were more than willing to buy the land than steal it. so thousands of Americans began to do something they would do for most of the rest of the century: move west. Out west was more an idea than a location, the latter of which changed as the country's borders changed. And the borders changed big time, in large part because of a slave revolt in Haiti. John Jacob Astor. He was the founder of America's first great fortune, and he did it the old-fashioned way, through brains, hard work, and political string-pulling. Astor was born in Germany in 1763 and came to New York at the age of 20. He parlayed a music store business into real estate, and after 1800, he got into fur trading and importing goods from China. When U.S. companies were barred from foreign trade in 1807, Astor had a clerk pretend to be a Chinese VIP who wanted to go to China for his grandfather's funeral. The trip was approved, and of course, the ship came back with a fortune in Chinese goods. During the War of 1812, Astor lost his trading post in Oregon, the first American post on the Pacific coast, to the British. But after helping to finance the U.S. war effort, Astor got Congress to pass a law banning foreigners from the U.S. fur trade. That allowed him to buy out his Canadian partners cheaply and establish a lucrative monopoly. By the time he died in 1848, Astor had amassed a $30 million fortune, some of which went to establish the New York Public Library. Astor became synonymous with wealth in America. Oh, the name of that Oregon trading post? Astoria, of course. Capitalizing on Napoleon's going on a business sale. Napoleon Bonaparte, Emperor of France, scourge of Europe, and namesake of a good dessert pastry, was in kind of a jam. In 1800, Spain had reluctantly transferred its control of the vast territory of Louisiana, including the key city of New Orleans and the Mississippi River, to France. Napoleon took it, with plans to create a vast new French empire on the North American continent. The following year, Spanish and French officials clamped down on the rights of Americans to use the Mississippi to float their goods and produce to New Orleans for overseas shipment. U.S. farmers and traders howled, and Jefferson considered siding with the British against France. "The day France takes possession of New Orleans," he wrote, "we must marry ourselves to the British fleet and nation." Instead, he decided to try to buy a way out. So he sent his friend James Monroe to France in 1803 and instructed Monroe and Robert Livingston, the U.S. ambassador to France, to offer up $10 million for New Orleans and Florida, or $7.5 million for New Orleans alone. But by 1803, Napoleon's plans for an American empire had hit a snag on what is now the island of Haiti. Napoleon had sent 35,000 crack French troops to the island to crush a rebellion led by a brilliant former slave named Toussaint Louverture, and it proved to be a very bad idea. More than 24,000 of the French soldiers were wiped out by the Haitians or yellow fever, and the disaster soured the French dictator on the whole subject. So when the Americans made their pitch, the French flabbergasted them with a counteroffer. Why not buy all of Louisiana? After some dickering, they struck a deal. For 60 million francs, about $15 million, the Louisiana Purchase gave the United States an area that stretched from New Orleans to Canada and from the Mississippi River to what is now Colorado and Idaho. That's 828,000 square miles for about 3 cents an acre. Surely, one of the best real estate bargains in history. But there was a problem. Under the Constitution, Jefferson had no legal power to make such a deal without congressional approval first. And he knew it, confessing privately that he had stretched the Constitution till it cracked. Undaunted, he pushed a treaty ratifying the sale through the Senate, and America doubled in size almost overnight. Now it was time to go see what the new half looked like. Duel to the death. Vice President Aaron Burr was a sore loser. So when he lost a bid to become governor of New York in April 1804, he was more than a little angry at his old enemy, Alexander Hamilton, who had helped engineer his defeat. In June, Burr sent a letter to Hamilton demanding an apology for slurs on Burr's character in the newspapers, which had been attributed to Hamilton. When the former Treasury Secretary refused, Burr challenged him to a duel. The two met on July 12th, on the bluffs above the Hudson River, near Weehawken, New Jersey. Hamilton, who detested dueling and had lost a son in a duel a few years earlier, reportedly fired into the air. But Burr aimed at his rival and shot him. Hamilton died the next day. Burr continued to be a slime ball. In 1807, he was charged with treason for plotting to overthrow the government, and, failing that, to create a new country in the West. He was acquitted because of a lack of witnesses, and then spent the next few years in Europe trying to find support for an invasion of Mexico. He died in 1836, largely, and deservedly, despised. Lewis, Clark, and the Woman on the Coin. Even before the purchase of the Louisiana Territory was a done deal, Jefferson had a hankering to send an expedition west. So, in late 1803, he appointed a 29-year-old army officer, Meriwether Lewis, to lead a group to the Pacific Ocean. Lewis, who was Jefferson's former private secretary, enlisted a former army colleague named William Clark as his co-captain. Their mission was to find a good route to the Pacific through the mountains, open the area to American fur trading, and gather as much scientific information as they could. Accompanied by 34 soldiers, 10 civilians, and seamen, Lewis's big Newfoundland dog, the expedition left St. Louis in 1804. One of the civilians was a French trapper named Toussaint Charbonneau, who served as an interpreter with the Native Americans. Another was Sacajawea, Charbonneau's wife, and a member of the Shoshone tribe. Sacajawea was the star of the trip. She gave birth to a son on the expedition and ended up carrying him on her back much of the way. Not only did she know many of the tribe's customs, but her presence with an otherwise all-male group also helped convince Native Americans that the tourist goals were peaceful. For her efforts, 196 years later, Sacajawea's image was chosen for the U.S. dollar coin that was first issued in early 2000. The expedition trekked up the Missouri River through what are now the Dakotas and then took a left turn through Montana, Idaho, and Oregon. Traveling by boat, foot, and horseback, the group reached the Pacific near the mouth of the Columbia River in late 1805. After wintering there, they returned to St. Louis in the fall of 1806, having traveled a distance of nearly 7,000 miles in a bit less than 3 years. The trip cost $2,500, and it was a smashing success. Only one man died of a burst appendix. Trouble with the Native Americans was kept to a minimum, and a vast storehouse of knowledge was gained, from information on plants and animals to whether there was land suitable for farming, there was, to whether it was possible to get there and back. Much of the country was thrilled by the stories of a strange new land just waiting to be Americanized. Fighting pirates and a dambargo. Things were going so well for the country in 1804 that Jefferson was reelected in a landslide. But while everyone was excited about what was going on in the West, there was trouble over the eastern horizon. To the shores of Tripoli. For several years, America, as well as other countries, had been paying a yearly tribute to the Barbary states of Algiers, Morocco, Tunis, and Tripoli in North Africa as protection insurance against pirates. But in 1800, the Dey, or leader of Algiers, humiliated the U.S. ship that brought the tribute by forcing it to fly the flag of the Ottoman Empire while in Algiers harbor. The action angered American officials and hastened the building of naval ships that the penny-pinching Jefferson administration had only reluctantly supported. The following year, the Pasha, or leader of Tripoli, declared war on the United States because it wouldn't increase its tribute. Over the next 4 years, the fledgling American Navy dueled with the Pasha and his pirates with mixed success. Then in 1805, William Eaton, the former U.S. consul to Tunis, led a motley force of about 200 Greek and Arab mercenaries and 9 U.S. Marines, which is where the "To the Shores of Tripoli" line in the Marines' hymn comes from, on a 600-mile desert march. Eaton's force captured the city of Derna. Coupled with the presence of American warships off its harbors, Tripoli was forced to sign a peace treaty, free the American prisoners it was holding, and stop exacting tribute. Although fighting with other pirates continued on and off for another 6 or 7 years, the victory was a huge shot in the arm for American morale. But the real foreign threat about to surface was from a more familiar source. Technical stuff. America gets bookish. On April 24, 1800, Congress passed a resolution creating the Library of Congress, even though it didn't have any books or papers to put in it yet, or any building in which to put them. But there were books out there. According to the 1800 census, the country had 50 public libraries, with a total collection of 80,000 books. In 1803, the first tax-supported library opened in Salisbury, Connecticut. The Library of Congress eventually got settled in Washington and began building a collection under John James Beckley, who was appointed its first chief librarian by Jefferson. Ironically, Jefferson had probably the largest private library in America, some 15,000 volumes. They ended up in the Library of Congress because Jefferson was forced to sell them to the government in later years to pay his private debts. No one likes a bloodless war. Britain and France were at war again, and the United States was trying to stay out of it. Again. One reason for staying out of it was that it was hard to figure out which side to like less. Both countries decided to blockade the other, and that meant French naval ships stopped American ships bound for Britain and seized their cargoes, and the British Navy did the same to U.S. ships bound for France or its allies. But the British also had the maddening habit of impressments, pressing Americans into British naval service. Britain relied on its navy for its very survival, but it treated its sailors so poorly that they deserted by the hundreds and sometimes took refuge in the American merchant fleet, where treatment and pay were better. So British warships often stopped American ships and inspected their crews for deserters. And just as often, they helped themselves to American citizens when they couldn't find deserters. In one particularly galling case in June 1807, the British frigate Leopard fired on the U.S. frigate Chesapeake, forced the Chesapeake to lower its flag, took 4 deserters, including a Native American and an African American, and hanged one of them. The incident infuriated much of the country, and the louder members of Congress called for war. Jefferson wanted to avoid a fight. Instead, he decided to put pressure on Britain economically. In late 1807, he prodded Congress into passing the Embargo Act, which essentially ended all American commerce with foreign countries. The idea was to hurt Britain, and France too, in the wallet, and force them to ease off American shipping. Bad idea. While smuggling made up some of the loss, American commerce plunged. U.S. harbors were awash in empty ships, and farmers watched crops once bound for overseas markets rot. Jefferson received hundreds of letters from Americans denouncing the damn embargo, including one purportedly sent on behalf of 4,000 unemployed seamen. Meanwhile, France and Britain continued to slug it out. Finally, in early 1809, just before leaving office, Jefferson relented, and Congress passed a milder version of an embargo. But the damage had been done, and the bloodless war was on its way to being replaced with a real one. Little Jemmy takes the helm. If James Madison were alive today, he might well be a computer nerd. He was extremely intelligent, conscientious, and focused on the task at hand. A neat dresser who was slight of build, 5 feet 4 inches, but he had a big head, and shy in public settings, Madison was referred to by both friend and foe as Little Jemmy. He could also be very stubborn. Madison was easily elected president in 1808. As the father of the Constitution, he was generally well regarded. Jefferson, who believed 2 terms was enough for anyone, had handpicked Madison to be his successor as the Republican nominee. And the opposing Federalist Party was in such bad shape it would have had a hard time organizing a one-car funeral. Madison inherited a messy foreign situation. France and Britain were still at war, and both countries had continued to raid American ships. Jefferson's efforts to stop this practice by cutting off all U.S. trade with foreign countries had nearly sunk a previously buoyant U.S. economy. So, Madison and Congress tried a different approach. In 1809, Congress passed a law that allowed U.S. ships to go wherever they wanted, but banned French and British ships from U.S. ports. The following year, Congress lifted all restrictions but gave the president the power to cut off trade with any country that failed to recognize America's neutrality. The French dictator Napoleon then announced the French would stop their raids if the British agreed to end their blockades of European ports. The British, quite correctly, didn't trust Napoleon and refused. But Madison decided the French despot was sincere and reimposed the U.S. trade ban on Britain. American merchants, especially in New England, moaned, and the British seethed. But Madison refused to change his mind. Dolly Madison, proof that opposites attract. If James Madison was kind of a nerd, his wife was anything but. Born in 1768 to a poor Quaker family in Philadelphia, Dolly Payne Todd's marriage to Madison was her second. After her first husband died in 1793, Aaron Burr introduced her to Madison. Within a few months, she was married to the Great Little Madison, as she called him. She took to being First Lady like a duck to water. After all, she had practiced for the job for 8 years as the White House's unofficial hostess, while Thomas Jefferson, a widower, was president. When Madison took over, Dolly assumed the task of decorating the Great House. Her charm also made her a great political asset to her husband. She is a fine, portly, buxom woman who has a smile and a pleasant welcome for everybody, observed the writer Washington Irving. Dolly also showed her pluck when the British Army invaded Washington and burned the White House. With British soldiers less than a rifle shot away, Dolly stubbornly refused to flee until a portrait of George Washington by the famous artist Gilbert Stuart could be saved. Dolly died in 1849 at the age of 81, 13 years after her husband's death. New Kids on the Block. Madison's decision was cheered by a new group of congressmen who took office in 1811. They were led by the new Speaker of the House of Representatives, a 34-year-old Kentuckian named Henry Clay, and a 29-year-old lawyer from South Carolina named John C. Calhoun. This new Washington brat pack had missed a chance to participate in the American Revolution, and because so many of them wanted their own chance to fight the British, they became known as the War Hawks. But there was more to the War Hawks' desire for war than just a chance to kick some British butt. Canada belonged to the British Empire, and more than a few land-hungry Americans thought it should belong to the United States. A war with Britain would provide the perfect reason to conquer the neighboring northern nation. Fighting the Native Americans again. There was also the perennial vexing issue of what to do about the Native Americans. For the first decade of the country, the American policy had been to buy, coerce, bully, and swindle Native Americans out of their land in the Northwest rather than go to war. By 1811, an inspirational Shawnee chief named Tecumseh had had enough. Aided by his religious fanatic brother, Tenskwatawa, who was also known as the Prophet and who urged a holy war against the whites, Tecumseh rallied tribe after tribe to join his confederacy and stop the white man's invasion. He urged the Native Americans to give up everything white, their clothes, their tools, and especially their alcohol. By late 1811, Tecumseh had put together a force of several thousand Native Americans. An army of about 1,000 U.S. soldiers, led by General William Henry Harrison, marched to the edge of the territory claimed by Tecumseh at Tippecanoe Creek, Indiana. While Tecumseh was away, his brother led an attack against Harrison. The result of the battle was a draw, but Tecumseh's Confederacy began to fall apart. No deal. Sell our country? Why not sell the air, the clouds, and the great sea? Did not the Great Spirit make them all for the use of his children? Chief Tecumseh, speaking to General William Henry Harrison, 1810. Why not invade Canada this year? In Britain, the long war with Napoleon and the trade fights with America had caused hard times, and a lot of British wanted to drop the squabbling with the former colonies and focus on the French. On June 16, 1812, the British government decided to stop raiding American ships. But there was no quick way to get the news to America, which was too bad, because 2 days later, Congress declared war on England under the rallying cry of free trade and sailors' rights. War was a bold and foolhardy move for a country with such a shabby military. The U.S. had about 7,000 men and few competent officers. Many of the top officers were antiques from the Revolutionary War 30 years before. One army official, Major General Henry Dearborn, was so fat he had to travel in a specially designed cart. The U.S. Navy consisted of 16 ships and a bunch of little gunboats that had been a pet project of Jefferson's and proved to be completely useless. And a sizable segment of the population was against the war, particularly in New England. It took about a month to demonstrate just how unready America was. A U.S. command of about 1,500 troops marched to Detroit as a staging ground for an invasion of Canada. When a Canadian army showed up to contest the idea, the American general, William Hull, surrendered without firing a shot. It was the first of several failed U.S. efforts to conquer Canada, which had looked so easy on paper. After all, the U.S. population was more than 7 million by 1810, while there were fewer than 500,000 white Canadians, many of whom were former Americans. The British Army had about 5,000 soldiers in Canada, but there wasn't much chance of them being reinforced because the English were busy fighting Napoleon. Still, the U.S. efforts managed to fail. After Hull's defeat at Detroit, another U.S. force tried to invade from Fort Niagara. It flopped when many of the New York militia declined to fight outside their own state and refused to cross the river into Canada. A third army set out from Plattsburgh, New York, bound for Montreal, and marched 20 miles to the border, only to quit and march back to Plattsburgh. Everyone's relative. Sam Wilson was a nice guy. He was born in Arlington, Massachusetts, in 1766, served as a drummer boy, and then a soldier in the American Revolution. And in 1789, moved to Troy, New York, to start a meatpacking company. Everyone liked him for his good humor and fair business practices. In 1812, Wilson's solid reputation landed him a contract to supply meat to the American Army. He began the practice of stamping U.S. on the crates destined for the troops. Because the term United States still wasn't often used, federal meat inspectors asked one of Wilson's employees what it stood for. The guy didn't know, so he joked, "Uncle Sam," referring to Wilson. Soon, troops began referring to rations as coming from Uncle Sam, and by 1820, illustrations of Uncle Sam as a national symbol were appearing in newspapers. Wilson died in 1854 at the age of 88. In 1961, Congress recognized his claim to be the original Uncle Sam. In September 1813, a U.S. Navy flotilla, built and commanded by Captain Oliver Hazard Perry, destroyed a British fleet on Lake Erie. Perry's victory was notable not only for the famous saying that came from it, "We have met the enemy, and they are ours," but also because it forced the British out of Detroit and gave General William Henry Harrison a chance to beat them at the Battle of the Thames River. Tecumseh, the Native American leader who was now a brigadier general in the British Army, was killed, and thus the Native American-Britain alliance was squelched. The victories kept the British from invading the United States through Canada, but the American efforts to conquer Canada were over. Things were a little better at sea. With most of Britain's navy tied up in Europe, U.S. warships like the Constitution, United States, and President won several one-on-one battles with British ships and so cheered Congress that it decided to build more ships. But none of the naval engagements were very important from a military standpoint, and after the rest of the formidable British fleet showed up and bottled most of the U.S. Navy up in American ports, the victories at sea ceased. Three strikes and the Brits are out. By mid-1814, the British had finally defeated Napoleon and sent him into exile. Now they could turn their full attention to the war in America, and America wouldn't be getting any help from France this time. Britain's first big effort came in August 1814, when a force of about 4,000 veteran British troops landed in the Chesapeake Bay area east of Washington, D.C. At the village of Bladensburg, the Brits encountered a hastily organized force of 6,000 American militiamen who quickly showed they had no stomach for a fight. Almost as soon as the shooting started, the militia ran like scalded dogs, and the British Army easily strolled into America's capital. The government officials fled, and the British burned every public building in the city. The burnings were partially to avenge the American torching of the Canadian city of York, and partially to take the heart out of the Yanks. Instead, they inflamed U.S. anger and delayed the British advance on Baltimore, which was the real military target. Remember, by the time the British forces got to Baltimore, the city's Fort McHenry had been fortified. An all-night bombardment of the fort accomplished nothing except to inspire a Washington lawyer who watched it from the deck of a British ship, where he was temporarily a prisoner. Francis Scott Key jotted down his impressions in the form of a poem on the back of a letter. After the battle, he revised it a bit and showed it to his brother-in-law, who set it to the tune of an old English drinking song called "To Anacreon in Heaven." It was published in a Baltimore newspaper as "Defense of Fort McHenry," but was later renamed "The Star-Spangled Banner." Soon, soldiers were singing it all over the country. Meanwhile, the British efforts to invade Baltimore ended. A second, even larger British force attempted an invasion of the United States via a land-water route through New York. In September 1814, a British fleet sailed against an American fleet on Lake Champlain near Plattsburgh. The U.S. fleet, under the command of Lieutenant Thomas McDonough, was anchored, and McDonough rigged his ships so they could be turned around to use the guns on both sides. After a savage battle, the American fleet prevailed thanks to McDonough's trick, and the shaken British force retired to Canada. The third and last major British effort took place at New Orleans. A 20-ship British fleet and 10,000 soldiers squared off against an army of about 5,000 American soldiers, backwoods riflemen, and local pirates who disliked the British more than they disliked the Americans. The American force was under the command of a tall, gaunt Tennessee general named Andrew Jackson. Jackson had already made a name for himself as a great military leader by defeating the Creek Indians earlier in the war. After a few fights to feel each other out, the two sides tangled in earnest on January 8, 1815. Actually, it was more of a slaughter than a fight. The British charged directly at Jackson's well-built fortifications, and U.S. cannon and rifles mowed them down. In less than an hour, more than 2,000 British were killed, wounded or missing, compared to American losses of 71. The British retreated. It was a smashing victory for the United States. Unfortunately for those killed and wounded, it came 2 weeks after the war had formally ended. Calling it even. Almost as soon as the war started, Tsar Alexander I of Russia offered to mediate between Britain and America, mostly because he wanted to see Britain concentrate its military efforts against Napoleon, but nothing came of the offer. Working on a settlement. Early in 1814, both sides agreed to seek a settlement. A few months later, America sent a team of negotiators to Ghent, Belgium, led by its minister to Russia, John Quincy Adams, and House Speaker Henry Clay. At first, the British negotiators dragged things out while waiting to see how their country's offensive efforts worked out on the battlefield. England then demanded America turn over loads of land in the Northwest Territory and refused to promise to stop kidnapping American sailors off U.S. ships. But when news of the defeats at Plattsburgh and Baltimore reached Ghent, the British tune changed. They dropped their demands for territory, agreed to set up four commissions to settle boundary disputes, and agreed to stop the habit of impressing American seamen. On December 24, 1814, both sides signed a treaty that basically just declared the war over. "I hope," said John Quincy Adams in toasting the treaty, "it will be the last treaty of peace between Great Britain and the United States." It was. The countries have never gone to war against each other since. Squawking about things in New England. In New England, meanwhile, Federalist Party officials had been chafing for a while about the dominance of the Democratic-Republican Party and the waning influence of the region as the country moved west. In late 1814, representatives from five New England states sent delegates to Hartford, Connecticut. They met for about 3 weeks and came up with some proposed amendments to the Constitution, including requiring approval of two-thirds of the states before any future embargoes could be set, before war could be declared, or before any new states could be admitted. There was even some talk about states leaving the Union. Although it didn't amount to much, it was a chilling harbinger of things to come. Eventually, three of the delegates were sent to Washington with the demands. They got there just in time to hear about the victory at New Orleans and the treaty at Ghent. They left town quietly. Thus did a goofy war end. Fewer than 2,000 U.S. soldiers and sailors were killed. No great changes came immediately from it, but the War of 1812 did serve to establish America firmly in the world's eye as a country not to be taken lightly. It may not always choose its fights wisely or fight with a great deal of intelligence, but it would fight. Chapter 8. Pulling Together to Keep from Falling Apart, 1815 to 1844. In this chapter, trying to hold on to nationalism, bolstering slavery in the South with new crops and inventions, setting the foundations for dirty politics and land expansion, debating states' rights, making travel, farming, and communication easier with technological advances. Fresh from a victory over England in the War of 1812, it was really a draw, America was feeling pretty full of itself in 1815. The country made big strides in pulling together. But like any adolescent, America was subject to wild mood swings. As this chapter unfolds, the country suffers an attack of the economic blahs, encounters some pretty sick politicking, and sees one of the most tragic aspects of its national character, slavery, take firm hold. There's also the election of Andrew Jackson, a speech from Daniel Webster that helps get the North ready to fight the Civil War, the coming of the railroad, and more shameful treatment of Native Americans. Oh, and don't forget the Alamo. Embracing Nationalism, sort of. By 1815, the generation that had brought on and fought through the American Revolution was fading away. James Monroe, who was elected president in 1816, was the last chief executive to have actually fought in the Revolutionary War. And as the revolutionary crowd faded, so did many of the memories of what it had been like to be individual colonies before uniting to become a single country. More people began to think of themselves as Americans first and Virginians or Vermonters second. The rising tide of nationalism showed itself in the beginnings of a truly American literature and art. The District of Columbia, rebuilt on the ashes of the capital the British had burned in 1814, became a source of national pride. But these nationalist feelings were sorely tested by several issues that different sections of the country viewed with different perspectives. These included the banking system, tariffs, public land sales, and Supreme Court decisions on the powers of the central government versus individual states. Taking it to the bank. The first bank of the United States, which had helped the nation get a grip on its finances, had been created at the urging of Alexander Hamilton in 1791. But it had been allowed to expire in 1811, and a horde of state-chartered banks swarmed to take its place. In 1811, there were 88 state banks. By 1813, the number was 208, and by 1819, 392. Most of them extended credit and printed currency far in excess of their reserves. When the war with Britain came, most of them couldn't redeem their paper for a tenth of its worth. In 1816, Congress chartered a second Bank of the United States, with capital of $35 million. The idea was to provide stability to the economy by having a large bank that would serve as the federal government's financial agent. But the new bank's managers were corrupt, stupid, or both, and they lent money like mad to land-crazed Americans flocking to the West. In 1819, land prices dropped, manufacturing and crop prices collapsed, and scores of overextended banks failed. The Yahoos, who were first put in charge of the Second Bank of the United States, finally got the boot. New management stepped in, clamped down hard on credit, and foreclosed on its debtors. But the Panic of 1819, the nation's first widespread financial crisis, triggered strong resentment toward the bank, which was nicknamed the Monster. The bank was particularly hated in the credit-dependent West, which saw it as a creature of Eastern financiers and speculators. The West's antipathy toward the bank drove a wedge between the regions. A terrific idea. The largest source of income for the federal government came from tariffs, the taxes collected on goods imported into the United States. During the War of 1812, the average tariff doubled to about 25%. In 1816, Congress voted to keep tariffs at those levels. The idea was that higher tariffs would not only generate money for the government, but also drive up prices on foreign goods and thus encourage Americans to buy U.S.-made products. Most sections of the country liked the idea at first, especially the North, where manufacturing of goods, from furniture to textiles, had developed during the war. But as time passed, the South and much of the West came to hate tariffs because those regions had little manufacturing to protect, and the taxes just drove up the cost of goods they had to get from somewhere else. This land is my land, but for how much? As a new country, America was attracting a crowd. In 1810, the census counted 7.2 million Americans. By 1820, that number shot up to 9.6 million. Much of that was the result of an astonishing birth rate, but an upswing in the number of European immigrants crossing the Atlantic helped as well. The crossing was relatively cheap, maybe $25 from London. No customs, no immigration, no passport. You got off the ship, and you looked for a job. By 1820, an estimated 30,000 people a year were doing just that. Although some immigrant bashing surfaced when economic times got tough, most newcomers were greeted with a big yawn. "The American Republic invites nobody to come," wrote Secretary of State John Quincy Adams. "We will keep out nobody. Arrivals will suffer no disadvantages as aliens, but they can expect no advantages either. What happens to them depends entirely on their individual ability and exertions, and on good fortune." One of the reasons for this attitude was that the country had plenty of room. Between 1815 and 1821, 6 new states joined the Union, bringing the total number to 24. And federal land was cheap and plentiful. $2 an acre for a minimum of 160 acres, with only $80 down and the rest paid over 4 years. But when hard times hit in 1819, even those lenient terms were too much. Many folks lost their land to banks when they couldn't pay the mortgage. The banks themselves weren't immune either. Many failed, taking the settlers' savings with them. In 1820, Congress lowered the minimum amount of land that could be bought to 80 acres at $1.25 an acre. The West supported the move, but the North and East, which saw public land as a cash cow to be milked for every dollar that could be squeezed out, were less enthusiastic. Public land thus became another sore point between regions. Orders from the court. One place where nationalism was secure was in the U.S. Supreme Court. Under Chief Justice John Marshall, the court consistently ruled in favor of a strong central government over the rights of individual states. In an 1819 case, for example, the court ruled that Maryland had no legal right to try to run the Bank of the United States out of the state by heavily taxing it. "The power to tax is the power to destroy," Marshall wrote, and states had no power to destroy federal institutions. In an 1821 case involving Virginia and an illegal lottery, the court asserted its right to review the decisions of state supreme courts in cases involving powers of the federal government. And the court ruled in 1824 that New York had the power to regulate steamboat commerce only within itself, not between states. Increasing industry. America was basically a country of farmers for much of the 19th century, but the War of 1812 had cut off the supply of many manufactured goods from Europe and encouraged the growth of domestic industry. The rise of factories. By 1790, the first factory devoted to spinning cotton into thread opened in New England, and by 1815, there were 213 such factories. Most goods were still produced and sold by individuals or small companies, but strides in manufacturing interchangeable parts to make assembling objects easier, the use of water and steam-powered machinery, and increases in demands for American-made goods all helped foster growth in the non-agricultural segment of the economy. Transportation gets rolling, well, floating. As the market for goods grew, so did the need for a sound transportation system. Congressional leaders like Henry Clay and John C. Calhoun were eager for the federal government to lead the development of roads and waterways. The idea of federal transportation subsidies was part of what Clay termed the American system, which also called for U.S. industry protecting tariffs and a strong national bank system. But Presidents Madison and Monroe balked, claiming that the Constitution limited the federal government's public works efforts only to projects that crossed state boundaries. Because most states didn't have the money for big road-building projects, traveling or shipping by road remained a real pain in the back pocket. On the water, however, things were a little different. One of the